Presentation wouldn't be complete without this kind of phrase. but I'll still go ahead anyways. So weights and measures. The original coinage, well, wasn't actually coinage. It was basically lumps of metal, I'll put it that way. The first mention of coinage, or well, of use of money, is in Genesis 13, that in this phrase is acknowledged that gold, silver, and it doesn't mention copper, well, cattle, are measures of wealth. So even at this time, it was still just not identified in terms of, you know, stamped with any insignia or anything, but just a pile of metal. But it still was worth something, which is, I find personally interesting, in that something like cattle, well, that's directly usable as food, producing, you know, other material, but silver and gold is actually just, well, it's just a material. Usher has this as 1921 BC, so this is still 4,000 years ago, and it's still recognized as something valuable. The first mention of use of money is in Genesis 17, where it actually talks about the purchase of a slave, actually. So interesting that the Bible uses a very sort of negative use of money as that is the first mention. The first actual transaction, though, where someone actually purchases something, is Genesis 23, where so Abraham is purchasing a burial place for his wife Sarah. So this is 1859 BC, according to Usher, so still about 4,000 years ago. So it's worth 400 shekels of silver. So at the time, well, what is a shekel? So there were various terms which represented different amounts of weight. So a shekel is one of the terms. So again, 400 shekels of silver, the current money with the merchant. So another term is beka. So it's actually given in Scripture in Exodus as a beka is half a shekel. So there's already a number of different kinds of weights that are given different relationships to each other. This particular phrase in Exodus 38:26 defines what is to become the temple tax. So everyone is actually to pay this amount of money. Gerah is another measurement where, actually also in Ezekiel here, means that the a shekel is 20 gerahs. And there's also a term called a manna, and that's also defined as, in this case, 60 shekels. It's kind of spelled out in a strange way. But a lot of Scripture actually gives you the relationships between things, so these weights and measures. A talent is another measurement. There's a lot of mentions of talents, of silver, of gold, of other materials used in construction and other kinds of purposes, not specifically for always purchasing something. So an ounce of silver. As an example of what we're talking about here, this particular coin, well, actually it's a silver ingot. I'll pass this around. Okay. This is a modern ingot. It's 1 ounce of silver. It's very fine silver. You can purchase this from a bank, or I actually got it from a bank about a decade ago. It's about 31 grams, and this is kind of along the lines of what the weights and measures may have been at the time, where it's not actually a coin, but it's a piece of metal that's identified somehow as having some sort of value, worth, weight. There were several monetary systems. Oh, go ahead. Oh, no, feel free, just jump in.
What does the E mean on that?
The E?
On that other coin you just showed.
Oh, that's actually just the insignia of Engelhard is the company that does the silver manufacture and the processing.
Oh,
so they just, it's one of their bars.
Okay.
So. Actually, it does have a serial number at the bottom, too. So every bar is uniquely identified. So the main system that these weights were defined from was a Babylonian system, where a talent is 60 mina, a mina is 60 shekels, and a shekel is about 9.5 grams. So the actual words that are translated as talent, mina, shekel, kikar, mana, siklus. So you'll see those actually in the original text, and then the English translations are these other words. These numbers are kind of, I don't want to say rough, but they were different styles of measurements, where, for instance, a talent, you had a heavy talent, you had a light talent. where the light talent was half the weight of the heavy talent. Or you had a talent of silver versus a talent of gold. So the actual weight itself would be different because it's a different material. There was also the two or three different kinds of shekels, shekel of the sanctuary, shekel of the king. They also had different weights. So a lot of these measurements aren't really well defined, at least in modern terms, but the relationships between them are pretty well known. So in this sense, a talent is about 36 kilograms. Mina is about 570 grams and 9.5 grams for a shekel. The system that the Jews actually used was a Phoenician system, which was derived from the Babylonian system, but now it's 50 shekels in a mina as opposed to 60. So basically the same. But the shekel weights were a little different. So a talent was actually 43.5 kilograms. So in terms of that silver bar that's being passed around, about 1,400 of those bars would be one talent. Or about 23 of those bars would be a mina, and a shekel would be about half of that. In the Maccabean period, the shekels are about 14.5 grams, so all those numbers are relative to that. If you have a companion Bible, I think it's Appendix 51, also talks about some weights and measures and values. This is one of the ones he mentions, although there's several other ones, like the heavy talent versus the light talent versus the talent of gold, etc. What do these things really look like? I mean, from Genesis 24, it's mentioned that there's shekels that are the weight of jewelry, like bracelets and things. So these things could have been actually just lumps of metal. They could have actually been in some other form. I think there's a verse from Job as well that kind of implies this, where the people actually might have been actually carrying around their money with them in terms of wearing something, like an earring or jewelry. So an example of what that might have been like, now this is actually much more modern in comparison, but the Celts, at one point, in this case, the top between the 8th century BC and 5th century, used ring money. So these were actual copper rings of different weights and different sizes that represented different amounts of value. Exactly what those values were, don't really know. But there were lots and lots of different kinds of rings. I mean, different diameters, different thicknesses. A little bit newer, from the same approximate range, is the bottom one, where it now has these sort of little knobs on the outside. So in the earlier ones, it's probably more like the actual metal weight was what it was worth. The second one, the knobs might represent something like a denomination or some sort of amount of value beyond just the actual weight of the copper. So I'm not saying that the Jewish weights would be exactly like this, but this kind of gives an idea what it might be going on. That's very possible. Yeah, so that's a... pass these along. Actually, we just want to take care of it. Nearly everything that I'm showing here, we have the actual examples of. So it might be easier to pass them along during the talk or just come see them afterward. So if you want to see anything specific, just let Jill know. These particular ones actually come out of her collection. We kind of pooled things in order to come up with this presentation. Mm-hmm. Yep. If you're very, 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 very lucky, maybe. Yeah, yeah, it's going to be hard to be that lucky. Well, first coinage. A lot of biblical history occurs before you actually have truly coins. Like those rings, you know, yes, it's used as an amount of money, but it's not really actually a coin. Lydia, one of the Greek city-states now in Turkey, it's on the Aegean coast, was the region that developed the first actual coins, or what people consider the first actual coins. So 7th century BC, so that's still much newer than 1900 BC, but not recent. These particular coins were made of electrum, which is a natural alloy of gold and silver. So for these particular coins, it was about 45% gold, the rest being mostly silver and a little bit of other impurities. The stater was the basic denomination, and then there was bunches of fractions of staters. If you think the Babylonian system again, where everything's based on sixes, you know, sixes, 12s, 24s, so here you have a third, a sixth, a 12th, a 24th, 48th, 96th. The third is called a trite, the sixth is called a hecti. The other ones probably have names too, but haven't found them. So the 96 would be a very, very small coin, and I think Chip actually has examples of that. Chip, by the way, he's a guest here. Most of what you see here, or a large portion of what you see here, actually came from him. He provides a lot of these for us. So Lydia, so this is an example of one of the trites, one of the third staters. The obverse is a lion. Some of these have rays or other indications around them. These tend to be very popular, since it's sort of the first kind of coins. The reverse is just a punch. A lot of the really earliest coins didn't really have a reverse. They were just sort of impressed into the metal, so you get some sort of dent or stellate pattern or some sort of nondescript, you know, other side. The Persian coinage. Well, time of Esther, 515 BC. So you know, Esther was taken under King Xerxes. Or Ezra, you know, Artaxerxes, you know, King of Kings, talk to Esther or to Ezra. So Esther has this as 467 BC. Or Nehemiah, 454 BC. You know, the 20th year of Artaxerxes the king. So there's a lot of biblical mentions now of people and places that could now be related to actual real coins that one can purchase hold. In 1 Chronicles, they mentioned the term dram. So the dram is the English translation of something. The actual word is ardakan, or darkin, I guess. Exactly what the ardakan was, if you have Strong's Concordance, he says that's a derrick, which is a denomination you'll see soon. In Ezra, the same word dram comes from darkamon, where Strong calls this now a drachma, but Bullinger calls this the derrick. So exactly which one was which, it's hard to say. But it is mentioned in terms of drams of gold. So in this verse too, it's you have talents again in drams of gold, and then measures of talents of silver, etc. So this is a derrick. This is Chip's derrick, actually. So it was named after Darius, Darius the Great, a Persian ruler. If you call it Cyrus, was the one who gave Jews basically their freedom again, that they were able to go back to Jerusalem. So Darius was his successor. So this particular coin minted about 45 to 420 BC, so it's the time of Nehemiah and Ezra and Esther. The obverse is a kneeling king, so presumably Darius, but kneeling with a bow and a spear. So you can see the bow's a little bit off the planchet there. So Darius was the father of Xerxes, so that was, it translated as a Hazarius of in the Book of Esther. And then Xerxes was the father of Artaxerxes, so in Ezra's time. And they all issued basically the same kind of coinage. And there's little stylistic differences, but it's basically the same sort of thing. Derricks are very hard to come by, by the way. But the reverse is an incus punch, so again, just not really anything specific, just a punch when they made the coin. The siglos is the baby brother of the derrick. So the siglos is the silver version of what the derrick is the gold version of. So about the same, roughly about the same size, same style. The sigloi are obtainable while derrick really isn't. So if you want to have a coin of the time of Nehemiah, Esther, Ezra, they're something that you can actually have as an ordinary person. A siglos is about 5.6 grams. So there was 100 in a mina and a 6,000th in a talent. So it's about half a shekel. So even though this is a different culture, really, using a different kind of measurement system, these are all kind of equatable to each other. Oops. So the reverse, again, is just a punch. Now, the Bible, well, you have the Malachi is a prophet, 430 BC, and then, well, the traditional Old and New Testament, empty space, up to the time of Christ. So you have approximately 400 years of, well, not scripture, but a lot of world history. So, for instance, Alexander the Great, I mean, he conquers pretty much all of the known world, and then his empire breaks up into various subgroups. The Greek city-states really kind of multiply, like Athens, for instance, or Corinth, or Sparta. Rome starts to increase in power. Other things going on in the world, too, like even China by now is creating its own coinage, India, the Middle East. So it's pretty much a European, Asian, worldwide kind of phenomenon now that things are happening. So a couple examples of coinage in that period. So here's a didrachm, so two drachma, about 403 to 60 BC. This is from Neapolis in Campania, which is now Naples, Italy. The obverse here is a water nymph. So a lot of these coins are, well, since it's pre-Christianity, so by definition, but pagan. And for some of these, it's kind of surprising how pagan these really are. So something like a water nymph, I mean, this could have been, you know, a local river or, you know, the nearby lake, and sort of the personification of that area. Okay. There, oops, too far. The reverse of that is man-headed bull. So if you read Hyslop's Two Babylons, he equates the man-headed bull with Nimrod. So Nimrod and Semiramis. So even a lot of the symbolism really does go back to, well, the core of biblical times. In this personification, you have Nike, which is the Greek personification of victory. So there's kind of a difference between personifications and gods, where a personification was more of a concept, like abundance or victory in this case, or luck, or some sort of well-being or fate, where a god was more of a natural entity, where it'd be, like, say, Jupiter or Hera, or a natural sort of person in a way that has certain characteristics. So in this case, victory is a pretty popular kind of representation. So you see that in a lot of coins because a lot of people sort of like to sort of represent themselves as, well, victorious for some purpose. So if they issued a coin to commemorate something like a battle that they've won or just to show that they have power and other people don't. There's a little coin, this noble, which is very small. Early 4th century, this is from Cilicia, is the region, and Tarsus is the city. So Tarsus as in Paul of Tarsus. So this was still a couple hundred years before Paul, but it kind of shows the kind of environment that he grew up in. So like this is Athena, which is the Greek goddess of wisdom, discipline, war. So not sort of the random killing of Mars, the sort of the arts of war. So you have to see her there in a military helmet with a crest on it. Oops, went the wrong way. There. The reverse is, well, it's a male figure seated, bearded, holding an eagle. A little hard to see in the picture. In this particular case, it's Baal Tars. So we hear of Baal. Baal translates as Lord. So there were a lot of different Baals at different times. Baal Tars, as in Lord of Tarsus, in this case. Alexander the Great, he issued lots of coinage, and then there was also lots of coins that looked like his that followed. This is actually technically one of those. So the obverse is Heracles, so think Hercules. Hercules is the Roman name, Heracles is the Greek name. And is wearing a lion skin, so very sort of powerful, kind of I'm in charge sort of image. And this was about 300 BC, roughly. Chip can answer this question better than I can, actually, but the reverse shows crossed legs, which I believe is one of the indicators that this is a non-lifetime issue. If the legs were not crossed, it would be issued in the time of his actual lifetime. Is that right? Yeah. So Alexander the Great died in, 323, somewhere around there? Yeah, BC. So the coins that were issued during his lifetime showed this figure seated with the legs straight. But the ones that were issued after he died were issued with the legs crossed. So this particular coin is a coin basically of Alexander the Great, but it's after he died. And we know that. Probably death or just some way to mark the coins as something a little different. There might have actually been real symbolism that don't know. So again, it's a male figure seated, bearded, and he's holding an eagle. But in this case, this is Zeus. So it was Baal on the other coin, Zeus on this coin. So there were a lot of sort of figures and personifications that kind of migrated from place to place in a way that one region would call the same figure something than some other region, or the characteristics of one of these personifications would then be sort of co-opted by a different region and called something a little different. But even in this particular case, I mean, even the representation itself, where it's a figure seated with holding an eagle and is bearded, I mean, well, it's, they even keep the look and not just the characteristics. Yeah, there. Here's another one. Here's a little copper coin. use the word, the character is AE there, represent copper. This is, again, a bit newer, 138 to 129 BC. This is Antiochus VII, the Seleucid kingdom. The Seleucids were sort of a derivative of Alexander when his empire broke up. Then one of the facets became the Seleucids. This was made in Antioch, which is now Antakya, Turkey. And this is the obverse. It's a little rough here, but it's Eros, who is the Greek god of love. So you have a Greek personification here of a characteristic. I'm hitting straight here. There. The reverse of this, it shows, well, you see the disc with the two palm fronds and the horns on either side. That's the headdress of Isis. So Isis was the wife of Horus, and she was the sort of the mother goddess of Egypt. So this is a coin where you have a Greek personification on the obverse, but an Egyptian personification on the reverse. So again, these kind of things just sort of moved around. In different regions, worship different things, basically. And this is the first coin I think you've seen that actually has an inscription on it. So the earliest coins didn't. I mean, they were things like the Derek, which just had the portrait of a generic king. But here you actually have characters. Greek was often the language used. It wasn't always, depending on the region. But in this case, the Greek characters are those. The first word is basileos, which means king. So you see that word a lot, because everyone's the king of something. And then the second word, Antiochu. So Antiochus. So in this case, the actual king's name is on the coin. Here's another one. This one's from Rome, about 211 to 206 BC. This is a coin called an as. There were bunches of Roman denominations, and this is actually one of the smaller ones in terms of purchasing power, as opposed to the size of the coin. It's actually a very large coin. So this one has a portrait of Janus on it. So you see the two faces facing different directions, forward and backward. Hislop equates this to Noah, actually, looking for being on the ante-living world and then past and then future. Generically, it was, the Roman god of gate doors, beginnings, and endings. So the word January is the beginning of the year, or janitor, as in the person who watches doors and comes from Janus. And the reverse just shows a ship, actually, part of a galley, and there's a little one above it. And Roma and the exerg, generally the sort of the bottom of the reverse of a coin. Often that's used for like a mint mark or a name or some sort of phrase. So Roma, yeah. So this actually is a Roman coin. And it's one of the earlier Roman coins. I mean, there were a few sort of, sort of larger copper lumps, basically. The A is root, A is graph.
Mm-hmm. Is it known, or do you know, which coins there were less made of than others?
Sometimes it's known. Generally, the lower denominations you'd have more of, but it all depends on the region, the time period, exactly what's going on. Like example, I was mentioning to Don actually earlier, is like even think the 20th century and say 1930 versus 1980 and what the U.S. economy was like. So that's even just a 50-year difference, and then you go from thousands of people in bread lines versus extreme abundance. So exactly how much of each given type is not exactly really well known. You can also look at how many have been found, too, where if there's been a lot of a particular kind of coin recovered from hoards and things, then you get a better indication of how many really existed at the time, because just the more that survived now is probably the more that existed then. So. Mm-hmm.
Where have most of them been found? How are they found?
That's a good question. Pretty much everywhere, actually, especially in Europe. Especially for the Roman Empire was everywhere. I mean, it spanned North Africa, all of Europe, into Britain. So people, even in digging up their farm fields, will find Roman coins. There are archaeological digs can recover some. There's actually a person I know who's a coin dealer in Wisconsin, and he was an archaeology student on a dig, and he found he was part of the group that found a small cup which had about 50 Greek coins in it. So just by digging them up in a trench, it was actually in an Etruscan trench.
Passed down through the generations?
I guess some could be, but considering the antiquity of some of these, it might be hard. People have actually collected coins for a long time. So there are old collections, like say the 1500s, you know, that might have also coins in it. So getting something this old would be hard to actually just pass down, but you know, newer ones could be survived. One coin I did not actually include in the presentation was just found by metal detector someplace that I had purchased from actually the guy who sells it from the metal detectorist. So they really can be found anywhere. Because we didn't really have money-producing cultures until the Europeans came here. A good example, actually, is the Pristina hoard, which was a hoard of Roman denarii, which you'll see in a little bit what a denarius is. But it was actually, was it 11,000 denarii that were intended for a military payment. It was actually going to pay the army that was in Illyricum. But somehow the payment didn't get there. So it was found near Pristina, Yugoslavia in the 80s, I guess. And then it made it out of Yugoslavia through the turmoil in the 90s, and it went on the world market. So that's 11,000 Roman coins found in one big pile, basically. So they can happen. Come on. Advance. Oh, fine. Do it the hard way. Okay, another example. Antiochus IV, Epiphanes. This is actually another one that Jill came across last night at about 10 p.m. Antiochus IV was the one who desecrated the Jewish temple. He sacrificed a pig there, I believe, and that started what became the Maccabean Revolt. So this particular coin shows, an elephant with a rider, not necessarily an Epiphanes, but could be. And again, the legend with Basileus Antiochus, so again, king. So again, this is not specifically, it relates to a biblical event. And the other side of this, so it's Nike walking. So again, Nike in terms of the personification of victory, but this is now on a Seleucid coin as opposed to a general Greek coin. So desecrated the temple in 167 BC, Maccabean revolts, and Hanukkah commemorates the successful revolt. So kind of a neat coin. So, birth of Jesus. So I mentioned when a decree from Caesar Augustus that the world should be taxed. So what brought people back to Galilee. So here is a denarius of Augustus. So this is a denarius, which was the main silver denomination in the Roman Empire. Denarii lasted for several hundred years. This particular one was minted in Lugdunum, which is Lyon, France, and somewhere between 2 BC to 4 AD. So it's right about the right time. These denarii are about the size of a penny, roughly, they became sort of the main staple of Rome. The obverse here, Roman coins virtually always have inscriptions on them. This one actually goes around the coin this way. So Caesar Augustus, DVF Pater Patriae, is what the coin reads. And Roman coins are in Latin, which, English is kind of derived from in a way. So Roman coins are often very readable. Unlike Greek coins where you have to have a little bit of background in what the Greek letters are. By actually looking at these, Latin doesn't have a U. They use the V character. There's no J, they use an I. Now there's no W character. But other than that, it's pretty close. Yeah.
From where?
This probably was just a slightly small flan for striking, where the for these particular coins you had what was called an anvil die, which is basically like an anvil sitting on the ground, and then someone put a planchet there, an actual disc of silver, and then they would have a mobile die which they would then put on top, and someone would strike that with a hammer. So if the planchet wasn't quite large enough, then the inscription wouldn't completely go. This particular one probably isn't. Considering the amount of detail in the rest of the coin. So a coin that's about this small, about the size of a penny, would probably wear fairly evenly. So it probably isn't just wear along the edge. There are later coins, like especially British silver pennies, which were clipped along the outside. So there were times when people would take silver coins and naturally just remove an outer little bit of silver from it. So that way they can just make that much more money themselves by having little bits of it, extra bits of silver. But this coin, you can actually see the dots on the side there. So that's really the edge of the coin. So this really was on the flan pretty good, pretty well. So these are the children of Augustus, remember right? And so we're standing there with two shields. So Gaius and Lucius, so that's the CL in the legend, and they were Caesar, which was their title at the time. So that was actually a question earlier, where you have Julius Caesar, so they kind of took the name Caesar, and that became a Roman emperor title. But then you have Augustus, this person, and that sort of became the primary title of the Roman emperor. So you had an Augustus, and so you sometimes were Caesar beforehand. Yep.
The word Caesar is also the predecessor for the word Kaiser and Tsar.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that's been kind of handed down. Okay, well, the wise men. Well, this is kind of an odd thing. So the wise men, Jesus born in Bethlehem. There came wise men from the east of Jerusalem. So who were they really? The Bible doesn't actually give names. They're just three wise men. It depends who you ask who they really are. So the Western interpretation comes from this Greek manuscript, which was translated into Latin and then called the Excerpta Latina Barbari. So you get Caspar, Melchior, and Balthazar. But the Ethiopians have different names, Armenians have different names, Syrians have different names. So who are they actually as people? Well, you can try to get coins of possibly who they are. And thanks to Chip, we have some. So take Gundafares as an example. So on the coins, he's actually written as Gudafarsa. So that's the actual inscription on the coin. That, you could think, changes to the word Gaspar, if you corrupt it in a good way, which is kind of similar to Caspar, which was actually the sort of Western name for one of the wise men. So it's like, well, maybe this is one of the guys. He was the first king of the Indo-Parthian kingdom, and so he was a wise man king from the east. So it's like, so you can't really say necessarily that really it really is him, but it's like, well, there's a chance. So there's a coin of Gundafares. So this is a copper coin, but still a tetradrachm. So we had the silver drachm from before, little coin, so this is actually a tetradrachm. The Indo-Parthian kingdom is now what is really the Afghanistan, Pakistan region, so it really is from the east. And again, Basileus. So you can actually, King Gundafari is the savior. So his name appears as king and is on the coin and shows his bust of him there. The reverse of the coin, this is a coin actually in Kharosthi, I think that's how you say it, which is an Indian language. So instead of being in Greek or Latin, you've actually got these little squiggles, which are the Indian script. And so it's basically the same inscription as the obverse, just in Indian this time. And again, it's Nike again. So now you have a coin that's basically now a Near East kind of coin, but it still uses the same sort of symbolism as everything else does. So these characters really just do move from region to region, accepted. Aziz II, he's another sort of likely candidate for being a wise man. I didn't come across good reasoning, but it's more sort of general time period. I mean, another wise man king from the east, right time he'd be ruling. So he's there on a horse. So this is the Indo-Scythian kingdom, which is now basically Pakistan. So similar region, a little further to the west. And again, Basileus, and you can read his name on it.
Mm-hmm. What was that?
Yeah, this particular one, this side is in Greek. So,
Pakistan.
Yeah, was now Pakistan. But Greek was still a well-known language. I mean, a lot of sort of the language of the intelligentsia, I guess. It's coming up. That's right, yeah, because he kind of spread everything, didn't he? Yeah, his influence. So the reverse is the same sort of Indian script. And now it's Zeus standing, holding Nike. It's a little hard to see, actually, and that's why I have this little guy now. But you have Zeus, the figure here, you have his arm here, and that's a figure of Nike. So, well, now it's a Pakistan coin, but Zeus, the Greek pantheon, holding a representation of victory. So it all just keeps the same sort of stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Say a minute ago about Alexander the Great.
The reason the coin had the inscription in Greek language, was that was part of Alexander's empire.
Oh.
So the Greek language stayed there after he passed on. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so when Alexander basically conquered everything, he kind of spread Greek and Hellenism, I guess, with him. And so that kind of stuck around as the centuries went on. Hermaeus, another potential wise man. So again, the right time period, 40 BC to the first AD. This is the Bactrian kingdom, so Afghanistan region, so another eastern area. And another one that's in Greek script, Basileus, again. This is a very rough one, but it was the best ship had available. So, and the reverse again is Zeus. So he was the last king of the Western Indo-Greek region. So again, he's a candidate. So now back to biblical times. So Herod. Well, Jesus born in Bethlehem. Herod the king. And Herod slew all the children that were born in Bethlehem and all the coasts thereof for 2 years old and under. So, the Herod that everyone remembers. There's a coin of Herod. This is a pruta. This is a Judean coin. These may have been issued, actually minted in Jerusalem. Later ones actually were. Caesarea was the region capital at the time, so some of these might be Caesarean. The pruta was kind of the larger of the copper, smaller denominations. They were issuing shekels, plus or minus that time period, which were silver coins still. There were fractions and multiples of the pruta. So this was a pruta. In Greek, again, you have H, the P is the R symbol, and then that's an omega, so O, and then D is a delta, so Herod. So you can actually read that on the coin as his name. So it's kind of neat to have a coin that actually spells out Herod. By the way, I'm also including some of these reference numbers, more for my purposes than anything, but there are lots of books on this sort of stuff. Here's one of them, which is Hendon's volume. He's sort of the definitive biblical coins person. But there's lots of books you can get if you're interested in the sort of stuff about how to catalog these things and background information. He provides lots of historical basis for a lot of the coins, too, so it's an interesting book. The reverse. So the reverse of this is a double cornucopia. So there's one there and there's one over here. So the cornucopia is basically a horn of plenty, like you've seen at like Thanksgiving kind of times. And there's a caduceus here, which is a sort of a staff with two serpents entwined around it. So that was a symbol of, it's different from the menacal symbol, which only has a single snake. Jill actually discovered that earlier today. The prudas and other denominations like this tend to be kind of rough, so these end up being actually nice ones for what they are, just as by the way. You saw the quality of the early coinage, which was actually very nice, say, for the Greek coins, but here they get kind of rough. So it's another coin of Herod, another one where he actually has his name on it. So Herod Basileus, king again, King Herod.
How Herod looks.
You mean where it is on this coin? Here it's a little rough. The inscription is around here. The particular characters, that's probably the sigma from here. So in this particular one, it's a little hard to see. In the earlier one, it was a bit clearer. But again, these things tend not to be all that wonderful. So it's definitely Herod, though, because this particular type is only issued by him, where it's in this side, it's got this this diadem and this cross. So we know it's a coin from Herod because it looks like that, even though the legend itself is not really readable on this particular coin. So since he was King Herod, the thinking is that the diadem represents the kingship. So people would wear like laurel wreaths and diadem crowns. He wasn't from a priestly family, but he appointed the priest of the temple, and he kind of had sort of semi-control over him. So it's thought that the cross represents, actually the X in this case, it's rotated, represents the priestly class. So he's sort of making a coin that says, well, I'm in charge of everything. A lot of these coins are that way, where it's the ruler trying to make some sort of statement, that he's going to be visiting someplace, he's got power over somebody, he's in charge of something. So, yeah. Okay. This is the first time using this today. The other side of the coin is a tripod table. So you have three legs here and then the table. The thinking here is that it's the service vessel's table of the temple that's being represented. It wasn't permitted to represent temple implements outside of the temple, but he did. But he's Herod, he does that sort of thing. and there's a little palm frond here. Let me see. Another coin of Herod. This side's kind of rough, but it's a cornucopia. But this is a little more typical of what you see in terms of prudas and such, where, well, this is the actual edge of the coin is here. So it's not really on the planchet. It's kind of halfway off. And that's what we have examples of. Yep.
And so then my second question is, are there, I mean, obviously there's multiple coins of these, and other ones are less worn? Mm-hmm. Because it has to be. I mean, how would you get, know that that was a cornucopia?
Right. I mean, these are different styles issued by the same person. So, like, this particular one happens to be both worn and off-center. but in the case of Herod, he actually had a series of coins that he issued. So I happen to have three of them, but all depends on the ruler and the type. So this particular one too is also a lepton, which is the pruta is worth 2 lepton. So this is actually a smaller coin actually than the previous one. The other side is the interesting one, where it is an eagle. It's a little hard to see on the actual coin, so I highlighted it in blue here. But that's the legs and the body. So this is the first coin issued by a Jewish ruler that had a graven image on it. I mean, you shouldn't have pictures of living creatures on coins, yet he did. But he's Herod, he does that sort of thing. So that was a neat one to find. And thanks to Chip, that was via him too. Well, Herod ruled between 40 and 4 BC, although these particular coins aren't really narrowed down to a specific period within that reign. So, yes. Mm-hmm. Okay. So the widow's mite. So, certain poor widow, and she threw in 2 mites, which make a farthing. So the word for mite here that's translated is actually the word lepton. So the same denomination you just saw, that's actually the kind of coin that the Textus Receptus records it as. And then the word farthing is a quadrans, which is a Roman denomination. That's a small Roman bronze coin. So it's all that she had was the interesting thing. Actually, this works sometimes, not always. So the word is lepton. As with the smallest denomination, there were 48 leptons to buy a loaf of bread at the time, according to Hendon. 384 in a Roman denarius, where a denarius was considered basically a day's wage in the first century of the empire, basically a soldier's wage. So if you only have 2 leptons, you don't really have much of anything. And she gave all of it. Which particular coins they were, though? I mean, you saw that was a lepton from Herod. So which is actually was the lepton that was the widow's mite? It's kind of a question. Alexander Janaeus is considered the source of the widow's mite, where there were a number of rulers which issued leptons, but he issued just huge quantities of them. And they were still in circulation 4 centuries later. So more probabilistically, so you can't say with absolute certainty that it was this, but chances are. So it is a lepton. It has a Greek legend. This one has an anchor on it. And it reads Basileus Alexandru, so as in Alexander Janaeus. So this was issued actually between 103 and 76 BC, so it was already in circulation for a century by the time the widow would have used it. The other side of this one, it's a star of 8 rays surrounded by a diadem. So you have this sort of star here, these dots, and then this ring around it. And then it's hard to see on this coin, but these are actual characters, letters, and it actually spells out his name. He issued more than one kind of lepton, though. They're all kind of similar, but they have stylistic differences. So here's another lepton. It's got an anchor within a circle. So like the previous version, except this one has the inscription outside of the ring. So still a widow's mite, basically, but a little different than before, a slightly different type. And this particular one, the inscription actually says King Alexander, year 25. So by knowing when his rule began, year 25 in his rule, you can say specifically 78 BC. So how you actually date these coins depends sort of on a coin-by-coin basis, where sometimes you might know what's a particular ruler, so therefore you know the time period the coin could have been issued. Other times, a coin like this actually has some indication of where in the ruler's reign it was produced. So then you can give a more specific idea of when the coin actually was produced, was minted. So.
Where would mite come from?
By the translation as mite in the King James. So so even though the word is actually lepton, it was translated as mite. And since it was the widow that gave it, so the widow's mite. Yeah. So, to Caesar. Getting stuck. Okay, so is it lawful to give tribute to Caesar? You know, show me a penny. So the word's denarius. So you saw denarius earlier. And whose inscription you hath it? And they answered and said, Caesar's. So, and so it would render therefore to Caesar, but it's Caesar's, and then God was God's. So this is known as the tribute penny. It's thought to be this specific coin. So it's a denarius. It's issued by Tiberius, which is the TI over here. It's a little hard to see over here. But he was the Roman emperor at the time that Jesus was having his ministry. So the portrait of the king, well, Caesar. and it actually says, you can actually read Caesar over here somewhere. So this particular coin was minted sometime after AD 16. It was minted also in Lyon, as the earlier coin was. And it shows Tiberius on it. And the reverse is, well, his mother Livia seated. So a lot of times Roman coins had their relations on it. And the legend here is Pontiff Maxim. So Pontifex Maximus. So there were, at the time, apparently multiple pontifexes for the different church leaders, and the Pontifex Maximus was the one in charge of all of them. So the word pontiff is still in use now as a derivative of this. Temple tax. So they shall give everyone that passes among them half a shekel. So the half shekel, this is an example of that. So this particular one was struck in 79 BC based on the regnal year on the reverse. It's the head of Melkart. So because of the quality of silver, this was the only kind of coin that the temple would accept. But that's a very pagan symbol on it. The story of the moneylenders, Jesus overturning the tables, that's what they were changing the local money into. And the money changers would even make a little profit during the exchange, because since the temple wouldn't accept anything else, you had to have the money converted into this. So this is Melkart, which is the lord of Tyre. This was minted in Tyre, so this is a Phoenician coin, actually. And he was the king of the city. The reverse shows an eagle. And there's a little club next to him here. And then the reverse says, of Tyre, the holy inviolable. So it's definitely coin of Tyre. I'll go a little quickly because we're running out of time here. 30 pieces of silver coin. For 30 pieces of silver to betray Christ. So this is really the same kind of coin. It's just the full shekel rather than the half shekel. So you still have the head of Melkart. This particular one, I wasn't able to narrow it down any further. So they were minted between 126 and 18 BC. So for basically a 100-year range, these coins were produced. And there's a reverse. So again, an eagle on a prowler ship. I guess I'll stop there. So again, the same shekel all the way back to the original denomination of a shekel being a weight was kind of maintained for now for 2,000 years. And even the current coins actually that are even a commemorative shekel issued by Israel, the one that actually Rick held up the other day in class, or in for the sermon, is actually the same weight as these other shekels. So.
In 5 more minutes, does
anybody mind going over? Is it okay if we go a little long today?
Or we could just pick up next time. No. Your choice.
Listen, though, if it's a good spot, stopping spot at the next 11.
Yeah.
It's up to you guys.
Yeah, does anyone want to continue, or do you want just to pause for this week and continue next week?
How much do you have for next time?
It'll probably be 10, 15 minutes more. So. But we can wait till next time. It's probably easier. So I guess if there's any general questions, anything anybody wants to know?
Plan on staying a little late next time just in case for months.
Okay. Sure, that works fine.
There are so many different types of coins with different images on them. Mm-hmm. Was counterfeiting an issue?
Yes, actually. Interestingly enough, one of the books I was actually they also brought for show and tell, Ancient Methods of Coining, it refers to how the dyes were actually constructed. And a lot of the ones that were recovered were only recovered because they were forgers' dyes. That the genuine ones were often destroyed after the issue was produced, so that way they couldn't make more. So the ones that were found were forgeries. So you did have contemporary counterfeits. You also had nearby regions sometimes making coins that look like these existing coins. So if you had an economy that was working well and you wanted to be like these other guys, like the Alexander the Great coins. 300 years later in Britain, you had the British Celts issuing coins that used the same imagery. It was kind of devolved in terms of style, but so it was now a British coin issued by British Celtic tribes, but it was based on an Alexander the Great coin from 3 centuries before. So you did have a lot of crossovers like that.
Those were official people of the government?
They would make their own dyes based on existing coins, and then just probably use if it's a silver coin, they would use a not as good quality silver. So they would pass it off as a coin of a certain weight or fineness, even though it really wasn't. So that's how they would make their profit. Yeah. If that interesting.
They'd use a copper coin and just cover it with silver.
Yeah.
So that's cheating.
Mm-hmm. Yep, that's why they're forgers and it's bad. Yeah. And sometimes those coins themselves are actually fairly valuable and interesting because they tend to be even rarer than the original issues, so people would want to collect those.
Most of the coins that you have here, are they gold or silver?
Silver and bronze are the ones that we brought today. And the Electrum one. So, not today, but next time.
So those heavy colored ones I felt were made out of bronze?
Probably, depending on which particular ones it was. Yeah, the small Electrum one, which was the first coin there, was partly gold. Yeah. But the other ones were probably copper.
Mm-hmm. Cultures would all have a paper currency?
Not really, not at this time. At least not in terms of currency. The Chinese actually had paper notes in the, 1100s, I think. So there were cultures about 1,000 years after this which well predated, our coinage or normal European coinage. But at this time, it was more the actual physical weights. That you didn't have fiat money, I guess is the good term, something that wasn't intrinsically valuable on its own, so something representative of something else.
Yeah. Charles, mm-hmm. If one of us common people decided to buy one of these coins, like on the internet, How would we know if we were getting the real thing? Versus one of those counterfeits.
Right. Yeah. The easy answer is to buy from a reputable person. For instance, Chip. knowing the person that's selling you the coin is probably the best way. And there's lots of dealers that are known to be reputable. If you know more about coinage itself, then you start looking at styles and surface characteristics, and then so if you get more into it, then you can get a better idea of what's real and what isn't. But to start out with, it's best to just trust people that are, or have good things. So. And a lot of these really are accessible. I mean, you can get a widow's mite for, you can even say.
Several widow's mites with me from anywhere from $5, $10, $20, and up to $50, depending on how well aware and mm-hmm. the strike, how mm-hmm. off-center it is, how on-center. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so things like the Persian Siglos is accessible. A lot of coins from Rome, which you'll see next week, if it's a 3rd century denarius, they tend to be very accessible, $20, $30, $40. 4th century bronze tend to be very, very common, like Constantine. So just because it's old doesn't mean it's necessarily valuable. Some of these are in this pile. But you can get things that do directly have a biblical connection or a historical connection for, you know, not very much, comparatively speaking. So. But there are lots of sources for coins. And going to local shows or something, there's coin shows that come in the area. Internet is definitely a way to do it. I mean, eBay is a source. There's a lot of dealers that sell directly online. Like, there's a site called VCoins, which specializes just in selling coins. There's a big section on ancient coins. So there's different ways to obtain them, yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay, that's about it.